Good morning, good evening, depending upon what part of the world you're in. If it's Friday, it is the CEO series where we bring together the most exciting people to discuss their careers, successes, detours, U-turns, learning points. And today, our guest is a very dear friend of mine, Jackie Monk, who's the managing editor of editorial operations at Presbyterian Hospital and a distinguished media executive. Her illustrious career includes roles at Real Simple, Wall Street Journal, Essence in Style, track record of implementing effective systems and mentoring emerging talent. She's been recognized with numerous industry awards. She holds a master's in management certificate from Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth and is the founder of Junebug Inc. Welcome. How are you?
Good to see you. How are you? Thank you for having me.
Thank you. To give some background to people that's listening in, Jacqueline and I will always have our Christmas breakfast.
Yes.
In New York, and we discuss the world's problem. We solve half of them over a couple of hours. So let's get started. You know, you've had an amazing career. I've always looked up to you, you know, from the time I started in the publishing business, because you were always one of the key players in the industry of publishing. Various roles in media. Can you share how the career trajectory as to from starting out, you schooled in Paris, which was another segment, and then you're here now doing what you're doing. Walk us through that.
Well, I actually got into journalism as a plan B because I had studied piano, actually. I had really wanted to be a concert pianist. But when I did not get into Juilliard, I figured I need to figure out something else. And so when I went to college, I joined the newspaper and I just fell in love with production and creating and storytelling and photography and every aspect. It was even more enjoyable than the music was. Mm. And so I was editor-in-chief of my college newspaper for 3 years and then went to Paris as an exchange student. And while I was in Paris, I learned I was introduced to really, really beautiful European magazines and kind of fell in love with color and photography and fashion and beauty. And when I graduated, I thought, well, I guess I'll go into newspapers, but I didn't have any connections in newspapers. And I got a job as an editorial assistant at a magazine called Beauty Digest. And okay. It was kind of like a precursor to Allure. It was very much about reporting. It wasn't a trade magazine, but it was definitely for people who were very, very interested in beauty and ingredients and efficacy, everything about beauty. And you had to be a reporter, but that was my beat. I didn't know anything about beauty. So I asked millions and millions of questions. I did very well there. And that's how I was introduced to magazines. Mm. And then from there, I had a career as a beauty editor for many, many years. And when I figured out that I hit a roadblock and figured out that I wasn't going to be made, you know, beauty director of Glamour or Vogue or any of those other magazines, I needed to make a pivot.
Tell me about it. Yeah.
So I mean, I love magazines. I love production. I love all aspects of it. I love the staffs. The staffs were always very nice to me. You know, it was the other layer of people who were not so inviting. Mm. And so that's when I became, I switched over to being a managing editor.
Okay. When I first got into the publishing business, you were one of the people that I was told you have to meet Jacqueline Monk because you were. Oh. And then when I saw your tagline, it says, "Leave it to Jack." I said, okay, I take care of business.
I like to be a problem solver. Yes.
Problem solver. So you came in from the business side, you know, so you learned it from the business side and you were able to translate over to the creative side. Was that the cut? You think that had an angle to do with piano, music, creativity?
Well, I was pretty much always in the editorial side, but I do think that the piano part made me more disciplined.
Okay.
I think that it made me more Yeah, definitely more disciplined and more detail orientated. And so I was always very interested in the finances.
Okay.
I always loved being able to have the resources to do what we needed to do. Mm-hmm. But if we didn't have the resources, I saw that as a challenge and tried to figure out how could I still get the results that I want with the amount of resources and money that I have. But what, you know, what can I spend? What can I trade? And I think that those skills paid off.
Yeah. So for my journey in that space, I found it very difficult to translate the business side to the creative side, because creative side was in another realm.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm talking business, and it was like we were talking at each other.
Well, I think that's where I think crossing over and becoming a managing editor, that helped, you know, because I could understand the business part, but I also loved the creative and understood that part as well. And I always wanted to be the person who could make the creative idea happen.
Okay. Okay. So that support structure to make sure we can get this done. You give them to me, but all the ideas.
And I always call myself an, you know, an editorial advocate.
Okay.
Tell me your idea.
Yeah.
And then we figure out how to make it happen.
Yeah. When did you decide that this is what I want to do? And you kind of left. I don't want to say left because it was still there. You kind of say, this is the direction that I want, and I'm going to move towards that. Was there a pivotal moment?
Well, I think in the early 90s is when I realized that I wasn't going to become a beauty director. Even though I was a beauty director at the smaller magazines, I was a fashion and beauty director of a bridal magazine, of a very successful bridal magazine. And it was a hard pill to swallow, but I decided that. And I thought about, wow, what else could I do? I thought, well, I'm not going to go to medical school. I thought of all different types of things that I could possibly do that I could do successfully. And I just thought, well, this is the space that I feel like I fit in. Let me see where else I can fit in and enjoy it. I didn't want to be in a spot where I did it well, but I hated it. I was only like 27 years old at the time. So I moved over into the production area. There was a lot less competition of people who wanted that job. But it was a very pivotal role, and it gave me access to a lot of information that I think many people don't have. So, you know, I got to see what it really cost to put the magazine out. I knew what the cost per page was. I knew what everybody was getting paid. Yeah. I knew I learned how to advocate for people to get raises. And, you know, it put me in a different sphere.
Yeah.
So it was nothing for me to start crying about, you know.
I would always, when I would have conversation with creative people, I'd say, learn more about the business.
It's so important.
You know, you have the great ideas and the colors and the selections and all those kind of things. I said, but learn a little more about the business. And I always kind of, even for people in human resources, I said, understand the business first.
Everybody. I tell children, I tell students that all the time. If I go out and speak to journalism students, you know, English literature students, even if I go to an elementary school, I tell them to learn accounting or bookkeeping. You need to learn how to track the money. Whether it's the entire budget or if it's just your own budget. And most of the time, a lot of times I go and I speak to underprivileged populations and I say, come on, you know, you can make a $10 bill stretch really, really far. You know where that's going. You can take those skills everywhere.
You know, one of the eye-opening moments for me in this creative concept is that we adopted Art and Design High School in New York. And I'd spend time over there talking with the teachers, and we had the teachers over for a teacher's day, the beginning of school. And I saw so many kids, underprivileged kids in New York, who wanted to be creatives, but their parents were telling them, go to school, get a degree, be a teacher, be accountant. That way you have a job. Capital B, 72
size. That's what I didn't want.
yeah. So do you cover that with because I said to them, and the kind of pivotal moment for me was Sharon Patrick gave a keynote at the first our first year. And a parent came up to me and said, you know, I've been always telling him to go to school to be a teacher. Not that I'm saying anything is wrong with that and to be all these other things, but I realized with her presentation and talking about her getting into creative, let him explore what he wants to explore.
Yeah, yeah. And this is when you were at Martha Stewart?
Yeah, that's when I was there, yeah. One of my crowning moments was to adopt that high school and work very closely with them because they were all inner city kids for the most part.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right. I mean, I just fell into magazines. I didn't even know how a magazine got created. You mm-hmm. know, I was on the school newspaper, but it was a big leap to learn how the magazine was created. But I did have the bones. I knew how to, I knew production and how to track that. So learning how to do it in a slick place, that was gravy.
Yeah, yeah. So learning the editorial side and your degree was in music.
Well, I started in music and I came, my degree is in actually in English literature. And because I'm so, I don't know, I have like three minors. I had like three minors. So I had to overdo it.
Yeah.
I was always counting all those credits and saying, you know, my parents worked really hard to get me through to school. I cannot not come out on time. So I graduated with like extra credits.
Okay. So as you walk through that, what were some defining moments to kind of switch around and put you on the right path to proceed to possibly where you are today?
Oh, defining moments in how I got into publishing or to proceed through publishing.
Defining moments in your career. Let's take it that way. Defining moments in your career.
Okay. Well, I really, really enjoyed music. And so I really, really wanted to work at the magazine called Vibe. And, you know, the defining moment was when I got there, I got the job that I wanted. And then I kind of didn't fit it. It didn't really fit. So that was kind of a defining moment and learned how to, and then learned, you know, I have to do a little bit more digging next time. You can't just look on the outside at how something is presented and think you fit in. And, you know, it was a beautiful magazine. The reporting was excellent. It was popular. But I had kind of grown out of the music, which I had not thought about, and so it kind of wasn't a good fit anymore.
Yeah.
But it was nothing that I regret going to. You know, I met incredible people. It was a young staff. It was the most diverse staff I'd ever worked with.
Mm-hmm.
And the weird thing is that from there, I pivoted to Real Simple, which was so different.
Oh yeah. That was Time Inc. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And I when I got the job at Real Simple, I thought, oof, now that I'm at Time Inc., they're putting me at the magazine that is on life support.
Yeah.
Because it was kind of on life support at the time.
Okay. Yeah, because that was the beginning of the transition, right?
Yeah.
But
I fit in. Well, I loved the content. It was, it wasn't just the content, but it was also where I was in my life at that time. I needed everything that Real Simple was promoting. You know, I hadn't been married that long. I needed to know how to decorate an apartment, cook food, clean. It was everything that I needed. And so, and that's why I think I could stay there as long as I did. And, you know, the team was also great.
Oh, okay. Oh, that was, I think that's when we met when you were at Real Simple. So, you know, when you talk about the media's fast pace, you know, and you said that you got to Vibe, which was your dream, and got there, it wasn't what you thought it was. And I reflected on a story of a young lady, a friend of mine, who is based in Hong Kong, and her goal was to get a job at Facebook, and she got the job at Facebook, and she called me maybe a month later and said, not for me.
Yeah, Yeah.
And so when you talk about the different dynamics of a workforce, I said, so what are you planning on doing? She said, I'm already looking. I said, you've only been there for a month. She says, why should I put myself through that? I'm like,
okay. Yeah. I feel like sometimes you get there and you know, it's like, but also don't beat yourself up about it. You know, it happens.
Yeah. Yeah. And she ended up going to, now she's in Taiwan, I think it is, for TikTok. And she says, "Up, oh, I absolutely love it." But I say that to say the workforce is different. Yeah. If you're managing a younger workforce, that's a lot different than managing a workforce of a while ago. What advice would you give to a new manager moving into a role? And there's a lot of dynamics going through. What leadership lessons would you advise that younger manager?
Oh, I always think, you know, be a good listener. Sit back and look at what's going on. And if you've hired people that know what they're doing, you know, set back and let them do it.
Yeah.
Give them the resources that they need. And then watch your business grow is what I think. Mm-hmm. You know, let people do what they do best.
So you talked about coming into, you know, Real Simple, and the magazine industry was struggling at that time. I just read the other week that Natural Geographic is no longer publishing the magazine.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I know.
Yeah. Oof. And now it's all digital. So I'm thinking from the business side, revenue impact, you're not bringing in the revenue that you would have had. So which means there's repercussions coming throughout. What do you think of the publishing industry today? I mean, the industry is going through.
It's so sad. I mean, you know, the print industry is,
yeah.
But I also think that, you know, people are just looking for savings, and there comes a point where you can't squeeze any more money out of something. Yeah. And I think that whether it's print and, you know, the line was, oh, digital is cheaper. I have never believed that. It's not cheaper, because you're not just going, consumers don't want a flat magazine on digital. You know, you have to have video, you have to have podcasts, and you have to have, you know, interactive apps and things. And that costs money. It's not cheap. And it also costs money to create really good content. You have to hire people who know what they're doing. It costs money to support investigative journalism. It's not cheap. Everybody can't do it. It's a craft. Mm-hmm. And it should be respected. Right now, I feel like it's not being respected at all. People are stamping all over it. You know, there are too many opinions. We just need the facts. Mm-hmm. And if you stick to, you know, fundamental journalism, you get just the facts. And, you know, too many opinions.
Yeah, it's a totally different experience. You know, I no longer subscribe to the paper edition of the New York Times, so I get it on digital. But it's a different experience for me sitting there going through.
Yeah, I still get I subscribe to still a lot of newspapers, but I do get they have a weekend subscription for the Times that I still get. That I love it. I love going through the newspaper, and you know, you see things that you wouldn't see that are laid out next to each other. So, you know, I think that's important.
And, you know, the Times was, I used to call it my Sunday evening exploration, because it was this thick. And I would sit there in the yard and go through every page and read it.
Yeah. I mean, we used to get four editions of newspapers on Sundays. I'd get them from my, I pick them up after church and take them home to my parents. That was my job. And then when I got older and would go out to clubs, I still brought them home at, you know, at night after being in the nightclubs. It was great to go get the paper first. I couldn't wait to get my hands on the Times. It was so thick back then. It was
So one of our frequent listeners, Jim Moy out of D.C., you see what he says? It's so brutal now. About good point. Just taking money out of a business is not a smart business.
I once was at a meeting and a CFO said, you can't cut your way to profitability. And I never forgot it, because there comes a point where you just, it's not working anymore. And you're compromising the product. And with journalism, you know, it affects the world.
Yeah. So John Self, who's a frequent listener and a prior guest, mentioned that journalism was my first plan B before healthcare. And yeah, so law was my, you know, law was my plan A, but that was not to be. And, you know, we all go through these career pivots. And this is what we try and cover on this show, because people's, what I call it, people see the top of the iceberg is where you are right now. They have no idea, no idea. That's what we went through to get to there, because trust me, it is a journey.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Yes, yeah. It is. But you have to have endurance. You have to persevere.
Yeah. And can't give up. So if you were talking to a group of journalism students today, what advice would you give them? Because they're coming into a landscape that's being totally disrupted.
Yeah, I would say, you know what? Find yourself a good mentor who's kind of gone through a lot of this, and
like yourself,
learn everything that you can from them.
Yeah.
And still keep learning. Learn what's new, but learn what's also, I think, get the stories from the past, because those skills are still needed. And I feel like they're kind of dying off. The way copy was edited, the process of how it would go from, you know, a junior editor to an associate editor, to a senior editor, and then go to the executive editor. They've cut out all those levels for financial reasons, but the consumer can feel it. You know, I once had a consultant say to me, well, when I was like fighting for not cutting jobs, they said to me, well, nobody has ever written me a letter saying, you know, that there's no associate editor here. And I said, well, they're not going to write you a letter. They're just going to not buy it.
Yeah. Typical consultant speak.
You know, the end result in that was, I feel like you stop getting invited to those meetings. They don't want to hear that answer.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about branding, because you've worked at probably all of the top major brands, in the industry, you know, starting with Vibe. Time Inc. was an institution within itself. They created so much talent.
Yeah, they did. They really did.
On Sixth Avenue, it was like a talent factory.
It really, really was. It was incredible.
Yeah, it was.
And it's missed. There, it's sorely missed.
I'm sure it is. I was in New York a few weeks back, and I came through Sixth Avenue early in the morning because I had done a walk around Central Park. And it was sad because, you know, I came past the Time Inc. building, and there was no traffic. The guards were just standing there. I mean, it's like a desert.
Yes, yes. I don't even know what's in the building anymore. I've gone by the building, and there is a block on the outside that says, you know, Time Inc. was here.
Yeah. Wow.
But that's it. It was a talent factory.
It was a talent factory. Yeah, you know, I've met so many people from that point, and still have a lot of dear friends who worked there at that time. So let's talk about branding, because lots of times people get hooked on a brand. You know, I want to go work here, and you may get there when it's not there. And you've made all the stamps for all the major brands. I remember reading when you were at the Wall Street Journal during that time before you ended up at Presbyterian. Uh-huh. I'm like, wow. I say that to say Carol Heimowitz, who was a writer from Wall Street Journal. And so she did a profile on me in Wall Street Journal. And I thought I had died and gone to here. I'm in the Wall Street Journal. But that's no longer a big thing anymore, because you can be featured on all these things. So let's talk about branding. Is it important to have the brand stamps there? Kind of like the passport thing to say, I've been here. Gives me a little more
value. I think you can't get caught up in all of that, honestly. I think you really have to have all of the skills and constantly develop who you are and be at your best and want to do the best and carry that with you. I think you are your brand. They should want you. And you should be able to deliver and bring what it is that they need. Of course, it's nice to go someplace and say, oh, it's the Wall Street Journal, or it's the New York Times, or it's real simple.
Yeah.
But anything can happen, as and everything has happened. And you have to be able to sustain yourself. Because you are not real simple. You know, you are not the New York Times. You are not real simple. Life is going to go on.
Yeah. That's
be ready.
So important. Yeah. You know, that was during 2007, 2008. I remember reading a story about, you know, all the mass layoffs and the financial crisis, and a pastor of a church in Greenwich, Connecticut created a support group because a lot of the wealthy people in that area had lost their jobs. And he said one of the key findings he found from that was people were so connected with, I'm an SVP, EVP at this brand.
Yeah.
And it, of all the trauma they were going through, that was the toughest thing they had to come to terms with, that because they got caught up in that.
Yeah. Yeah. I learned that really early. I used to work at a magazine called New Woman, and I became the beauty editor. And that was when I became one of the first African-American beauty editors. And from there, I went to a bridal magazine, and I thought that was a step up. I thought, well, I'm going into a place where beauty is really important on your wedding day. Mm-hmm. But the industry didn't see it that way.
Okay.
And they saw the bridal industry as sort of as a niche industry, not as important as a general market magazine. And so when I got to a bridal guide, people stopped taking my calls. Like, I didn't get straight put through all the time, like I did when I was at New Woman. Okay. And I learned that, oh, okay, they don't respect the bridal industry as much as they respected the other industry. But it, you know what? I was like, okay, I see that I am not New Woman. I am not going to be just bridal guide. I have to just be Jackie Monk.
Okay. I say Claudia Bloom said you were the best managing editor ever.
Hi, Claudia. Thanks, thank you.
Thanks, Claudia, for that stamp. Yeah, that's so cool. But, you know, but Jacqueline, I tell you this, and you and I have been knowing each other for years. Everyone I talk to basically says the same thing. So it's not, Claudia says that, but I've heard that.
I've been very fortunate and worked with super, really bright people. Yeah. I really, really have. And I appreciate it. And, you know, as Claudia knows, we have a nice group that still stays in touch from Real Simple. It was not just any old job.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. That was like, it was kind of like having a fraternity that you have developed.
It was, I guess, you know what? I never thought of it that way. I didn't belong to a sorority. I feel like it's like a lifetime group. And I really do think everybody is so supportive still, you know, and I started that job in 2001, and we're still, and Claudia was there in 2001. Claudia was there before I got there.
Oh, wow. That's so cool to hear that. So let's talk through, how do you get accolades like that? How do you become a leader that people respect, a leader that people come to you? And you said the key point is to listen. How did you develop that skill?
You know what? I think I worked for enough people who were terrible. And I thought, I worked for some managing editors, and I thought, you know what? I don't have that. I would run away from them. I was doing the job of a managing editor, and I didn't know it. I still was being called like executive editor or fashion and beauty editor, but I was functioning in a managing editor role. And someone from the outside came in and told me, you're really being a manager. You're really the managing editor here.
Okay.
And I was like, no, I don't want to be the managing editor. Those people are horrible. So I just worked to not be that type of managing editor. I wanted people to come to me with the problem. If you foresee something going off the rails, please come and tell me early. I'm not going to be angry. We're going to work it out. You know, what I don't want is to find out after the fact.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, if you respect people, they respect you.
It's important that you said that, because there's learnings that you could pick up from a great manager. There's learnings you can pick up from a horrible manager.
Yeah.
And when I look back on my career, I had one manager that was so horrible. I said, if I just flip that and did 180 degrees from what she did, I'll be successful.
Exactly. Well, that's what I thought about that as well. I just worked with people that were, you know, telling lies and
Yes. You know. The minutia that you go through, right?
Yeah. And I just never wanted to be part of that.
Yeah. So let's talk about listening. You said listening. Everybody says, yeah, I listen. I said, no, you listen for pauses and so you can put your 2 cents in. But do you really listen? Any key thoughts on listening? You know, workers come to you and they could be, if you built the trust, they will come to you and share.
Yeah.
What is Jackie's model for listening?
I listen, I take notes, I look for patterns.
Okay.
And frequently you will see a pattern. If someone is coming to you with something that they feel in the office isn't working, you know, somebody else may be coming as well. What I really worked to do is not have problems fester.
Okay.
And that's really bad. And I think a lot of managers will not want to deal with it. They'll just keep putting it off and think it'll go away. And, you know, it's like a pimple. I'm like, no, let's get rid of it. Let's get rid of it before it inflames. Yeah. And if I can't fix it, then I go to the next person who can help me fix it.
Okay.
But we're going to work to try to not have something blow up.
Okay. So I want to put you into a scenario. You're speaking to a group of senior level publishing media executives. What advice would you give them as it relates to building an inclusive workforce, building an engaged workforce, to listen more? What advice would you give the so-called big shots, as my father would say, the big shots? What talk would you give them of what key points?
Well, the key points I think are, you know, hire competent people, pay them well, back up, and let them function. Okay. And, you know, cheer them on when they do well. You know, be a person, you know, be a resource for solutions when they need them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's complicated. I think, you know, pay people what they're worth is important. Yeah. And I think that's a real big problem right now.
Yeah.
And people come to work and they don't bring their 100% to work. And you know why? Because you're not paying them to.
Authentic self.
Yeah. You know, I don't know about that authentic self stuff. I don't know if everybody can be all that authentic.
Okay.
All the time. You know, I bring who I am to work. I'm not going to bring who I am who I was at a Prince concert to work.
But, you know, defensive of the culture, you know,
that may be
pretty cool though, you know, oh, wow. I didn't know you went there, you know. Okay. That's cool. So we talked about, you know, from the leadership side and being, you know, listening more and the role that they play, the culture of an organization. So when we talked about time, there was a culture there. When you look at all the talent that came out of there, that was a nurturing environment. Do you think maybe because that was kind of a family-owned business at one time, and it was, I don't like to use the business as like a family, but it's kind of a nurturing that was going on there. And people stayed. There was no basically turnover.
Yeah,
people
I know.
Had, they stayed.
I know. When I joined Time Inc., I was in my mid 30s, and I'd met people who were the same age as me, and they had already been there like 15 years.
Yeah.
It was incredible. I was like, what? And there are people that had never worked anywhere else.
Anywhere else. Yeah.
No, I mean, they, you know, the key there, I think, is that they hired people who were competent. If you weren't, they kind of got rid of you really pretty quickly. But they supported you, I found. And they also spent money in finding out how to make things work better. They were always trying to make things better, not cheaper. They were always bringing in people and, you know, to examine the pages and have focus groups. And you didn't have to listen to what they said, but they wanted to give you the information so that you could make better decisions or informed decisions, that you had every aspect in how to be the best. You know, they sent the teams out on, and real simple, we had like 3 offsites. I constantly kept thinking they were going to stop them because they were so expensive. But every time that we did them, we came back with a project on how to make the brand grow. And they took that idea and they did it and it grew. Mm-hmm. So they knew how they were investing their money.
Yeah. So so if you take that back to the C-level said that's an investment in the workforce and it's not an expense. Because I remember I was going to Paris for vacation and I was talking to some of some of our creative people. Every year they would do these tours and all the designers would go to Paris. They'd go to Rome and exploration, kind of immersion. What can they come back from that? And I'm thinking right away the business side. I'm thinking about the cost of that. But then you say you come back and then you build it back into the brand and you are able to do things.
Yeah.
Companies today probably can't afford to do that
from the business side. I don't think that's true. I think that they're just being short-sighted. I think they need to build it in. They need to build it in as part of the work environment.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you can't afford to be doing it.
So let's talk about influences. I mean, you started out, piano career detours and all of that, and you were able to bounce back at each level. You made some left turns when you should have gone right, and you were able to get it back on track. Who is it? Give me some names who were essential influences in your life, in your career. And, who were they? I know you just lost your mother a couple of years ago.
I lost her at 99.
Yeah.
She was a huge influence. Huge influence. Yeah. Very strong woman.
I know. Yeah.
Who was an example of when something doesn't work, you don't have to stay there. You go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. She grew up in the South. She was from Virginia. Okay. And she was born in 1920. And she got married and it didn't work. And she divorced him.
Okay. And during that time,
that was pre World War II. She said, "This is not working. This is not working." And and she was expecting at the time. And she said, "This is not working. I'm going back home." Luckily, thank God, her family took her back in.
Okay.
And she eventually moved to New York, where she met my dad, and they built a very loving home.
Okay.
And so she's, both my parents were incredibly encouraging. But as far as journalism, I've met with a lot. I've gone through a lot of people who have been very helpful. I've had influences of, I met Shirley Chisholm when I was, 9. She was a big influence. She came to speak at my church for Women's Day. She was running for president at the time.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And, she's from Brooklyn. I'm from Brooklyn. And in the industry, I've met several people. I used to work for a woman named Linda Stacy. She gave me my first job out of college. Mm-hmm. She worked at the Post now. When I got to Time Inc., everybody was kind of really nice. I mean, I know that a lot of people didn't have such a great time, but, I met people like Rhonda Joy McLean and Cheryl Tucker.
I think Rhonda's listening because she sent a note. She was going to be tagged in. Rhonda Joy, hey.
A woman named Cheryl Tucker. I mean, my editor-in-chief was great. Kristen Van Ottrop was very, very encouraging and not micromanaging, trying to do the job of a managing editor. She said, I'm the editor in chief. I got to do the text and the content over here. This is yours. Okay. And that worked out really well. Even Martha Nelson, I know some people had issues, but she was fantastic. Such a smart lady.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'd go to her and she'd give me the script of what to say in a meeting and it worked.
Ooh, okay.
lots of people have been super nice and it pays to have really good friends, that you make going up the ladder as well.
Yeah.
Claudia and I are still friends, Corinne Corbett, Suzanne Rust, it goes the gamut. You never stop being in touch with these people.
Yeah, I call it board of directors. Those are my board. Those are
That's what I need to call it. That's what I. Yeah. But I think I'm going to call it my choir of directors.
Your choir of directors. Okay, cool. And you know, I said this in the beginning of the show. You and I have an annual meeting every Christmas holiday.
Yes.
And we have this long breakfast that starts, and we end up talking for 2 hours. And I think we're the only ones left for breakfast by the time.
I know it's lunch by the time we leave.
Yeah, by the time we leave there. But it's always cool. So you talk about leadership lessons that you've learned throughout your career. One of the things that keeps popping up, you said that hire great people and let them do their job. And I thought about, I don't know whether it was Steve Jobs that said, if you hire great people, just let, or the guy from Microsoft, if you hire great people, let them do it and stay out of the business.
Yeah. Yeah. One time when I was at Time Inc., we had a meeting and they pulled the staff together and there was a man there at the time running it. His name was John Huey. And he came into the meeting and he said, I don't know what you're doing, but keep doing it.
End of meeting. Yeah.
I was like, you know, great, please.
Yeah. Let me go back and do that some more. there was an article from the guy from Airbnb after 9/11. And he was talking about, you know, whether to come back to work. But he said, you know what? I don't care where you work. You've done great work leading into this and you'll do great work coming out from this. I don't care. We're not going to have a policy. If you want to work it out with your manager, we're cool.
Smart man. And you know what? His sister worked at Real Simple.
Really?
Yes. Yes. She worked in our fashion department.
Oh, my goodness. That was so cool. Yeah.
She's still a friend, too.
She's still a friend. Okay, cool. So let's talk about, as we begin the process of closing down, one of the goals of the show is to bring forth leaders like yourselves, because I said we all get caught up in this iceberg theory and all we see is the top. And we don't understand what you went through to get there. And that's the mission of the show. And you brought that out today. Are there any takeaways you would give us as it relates to the show, being a guest on the show? And I know you've listened a couple of times. Any last minute thoughts?
On takeaways on how to do what? Improve the show?
No, not how to improve the show. Takeaways, lessons learned that you'd like to impart on the guests as you close out. Yeah, yeah.
I just think people need to respect each other more and respect what everybody does. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like there are many jobs that get disrespected. And just because someone isn't in the shiny seat at the top of the boardroom, you still need that person.
Okay.
You know, they may be keeping you out of having a defamation lawsuit, like, and thinking about like researchers who often don't get a lot of praise, copy editors don't get a lot of praise, but you try to run a content business without them.
Mm-hmm.
it doesn't roll very well.
Yeah.
So be nice. I guess it's be nice to, I'm not going to call them little people because they're not little people, but be nice to the people who aren't in the top earning positions.
Yeah. You know, my metaphor for that is when I talk to he said shiny seats. I call it the big shots. My father would always call it, he said, the big shots inside of the organization. So that's my metaphor for shiny seats. But I say the small people. If you look in the lower end of the totem pole, and this was some research that we had done from when I was one of my roles was the CEO of a great place to work in Dubai, where I am today. And people's memory of people's names and jobs diminishes as you go down the org chart.
Oh.
Yeah, because from here, I know everyone here. When it gets here, it gets a little cloudy, and as you go down, and the key to that is you understand the small. And I learned that from Martha Stewart, because Martha would come in sometime and she'd sit inside the room, the mail room, and just talk to people. And nobody's intimidated by that.
That's
Sharon Patrick on Monday morning football season, she was inside as her first stop, discussing the games, arguing with the guys in the mailroom.
Yeah.
But when you set that kind of pattern, everyone else, smart people will learn from that.
Yeah. It rolls from the top, but the people, like I said, not in the shiny seats, keeping you out of court, you don't want a lawsuit. You don't want.
Yeah. I'm gonna send you a royalty check on the shiny seats, because I may change the metaphor from the big room to the shiny seats. So Jackie, thank you so much for being a guest. It was
so
cool to have you as a guest, and I'll see you for our annual breakfast.
Yes, that will be great.
And we'll solve 3/4 of the world's problems, as we always do.
We got a lot to do today.
A lot to do this year, right?
Yes.
Okay, so thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I'll be in touch. Hang on as we close out.
All right. Okay.